All right, so let's get started because, as it is, Jewish standard time, we're already 5 minutes behind schedule. But we're going through, as we are all familiar, but just to bring some of our new people up to speed. This class has been all about touring the Jewish home, and we're going from room to room, from porch to basement to wine cellar to everywhere, front door. We've covered a lot of beautiful rooms where we talk about the mitzvos that are associated with each room. It's been a fascinating journey. It really has been. And just the other week, we entered into the inner sanctum known as the bedroom. And yes, everybody's eyes were all lit up, waiting to hear what will Rabbi T have to say about the bedroom that can actually be recorded. So far, so good. We haven't really done anything inappropriate, but we did last week talk about the beauty about intimacy. We talked about how the Torah really emphasizes the level of connection that a husband and a wife share, not just in the spiritual sense, which is clearly a part of it, but even in a physical sense, in a very pure physical way, their bond is built through physicality as well. And we spent time talking about that. Tonight, I want to build on that. And I want to talk about really an aspect of marriage between a husband and a wife that I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about. It goes as follows. Okay, let's start. When I was in ninth grade in high school, we had biology 101. Biology, we're all familiar. Everybody here has already graduated high school. Okay, that was an assumption, but I'll work with it. But everybody knows basic biology, and that is that males and females have different bodies and they experience different things physically as well as physiologically. The females go through a cycle. They go through a monthly cycle. It's an experience of where, again, I'm not sharing anything that you all don't know, and that is that it goes through a period of where, you like that pun? I got it in there. Goes through a period of time of where the uterine lining doesn't, the egg doesn't fertilize with the sperm so that a child, an embryo can be created. And hence, every month or so, the lining of the uterus sheds. That's called the bleeding, right? The menstruation period, and goes through that cycle approximately every month. It's not just a fluke, and it's not just a, okay, that's just the way we're created. There's a lot of, the designer of our bodies, the designer, God, took this all into consideration, and we have to ask, what's it all about, and what is it relevant? How is it relevant for us in the 21st century? In the old days, it was who knows what. They had all these different ideas, but the Torah is very clear. I want to just present it in this manner. A woman who has her period, at that point, husbands and wives are not to be intimate. The physical part of the relationship is to be put on hold. Now, some of you will get cynical, and that's perfectly fine. And that is, you don't want to be intimate at that time. It's not the most comfortable time period of the month. And it makes a lot of sense. But obviously, it goes much, much, much deeper than that. Let's just fast forward. There's a period of time of where husband and wife are not being physically intimate. But then at some point, which we're going to discuss, it changes, and now they are allowed to be intimate. Where and how does that change? Is it just a magical, okay, we counted 3 days, everybody's feeling up to it, or we counted 5 days, 8 days, whatever it is, and now everyone is on the same page and we can have intimacy again? Well, the answer is no. The answer is that there is a process. I'm going to oversimplify it, but I'm happy to answer questions. Simply put, after the bleeding stops, typically anywhere from 5 to 7, 8 days is a typical period of where she'll bleed. At that point, The Torah wants to make sure that all the uterine bleeding has stopped. If it can be determined, if it can be determined that the bleeding has stopped, the next part of the process is that the woman goes to the mikvah. Okay? The mikvah. That's the Hebrew word. In English, they call it the ritual bath. A lot of misnomers, a lot of crazy myths about what's in a mikvah, how does it work, and who. Let me very simply put it this way. It is a little, it's not even so little. In most cities nowadays, it's a pretty decent size. I'll call it a pool. You're not doing the backstroke and we're not practicing the different breaststrokes and, you know, whatever. That's not what it is. It's approximately, again, different cities, depending on the size of the Jewish population, will have smaller and larger mikvah. But typically, a classic mikvah, you can, I don't know, I'll use the terminology. How much is a saw? A saw is... I'm approximating, holds 150 gallons of water. 150 gallons of water. That's a decent size pool, reservoir, whatever you want to call it. This is a unique aspect. Why? Because the Torah tells us that what makes a mikveh unique, or the water inside the mikveh, I'll use the term rainwater. But don't get grossed out. This is where the myths come from. It is not actually a collection of real rainwater.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that? Didn't know that. Okay, so let me explain this. And again, stop me, because I'm going to throw a lot at you right now. The Torah tells us that for a mikveh to be considered a purification process, and we'll talk why it's needed, but for it to be, it has to be from a natural source, a spring, a river, a stream, an ocean, a natural body of water. It can't be something that was collected in a vessel. Most of our water, when you turn on the tap in your sink or your kitchen, whatever it is, it has already been collected and it's going through pipes to get to your house. Even if you're on well and septic, it still uses those mechanisms. It's not coming, and it is not, and it does not have the properties of being through the natural rain or the natural water source. The water that's collected in a mikvah is natural rain water. It's collected. It's not first gathered in a vessel, in a large tank, that then gets transferred into the pool. That is not how it works. The way it works is they actually collect the rainwater through mechanisms, which are very technical. I'm not going to get into it, but it doesn't go through any formal vessel. It doesn't go through what we call a kli, a vessel. It then is collected in a natural pit. Dug out. Okay. Now, I don't know about you, but if I had to go immerse myself in that, I don't know how quick I would be to do it. It's not exactly the most, it doesn't sound the most hygienic. It doesn't sound enticing for me to go immerse myself in a collection of water that's rainwater that happens. It just not, it doesn't work for me. You and I are not the first ones to face this problem. So in the Code of Jewish Law, it gives a fascinating advice on how to do this so that everybody can be happy. Okay? Imagine next to this pit, next to this collection of rainwater, you have a second pit, a second pool, if you want. Let's call pool one and pool two. Pool two is 100% tap water, what you and I bathe in all the time. Your baths, your showers are classic tap water. You turn on the spigot, you turn on the faucet, it's water. You fill pool number two with non-rainwater, regular, plain, old-fashioned tap water. Remember, pool one is over here, Pool two is right next to it with tap water. Rainwater in pool one, tap water in rain in pool two. The engineers of the mikvah are smart people, and they follow the code of Jewish law, which tells them that what they are to do is to build a hole. There is a hole that connects pool one to pool two that has a removable plug. You got the picture in your head? Two pools next to each other, but there is a passageway. Remember the game of Clue, a secret passage? Right. This is what it is. You have an actual hole that would, in theory, allow water from pool one and water from pool two to mix. As soon as you undo the plugs, the property of water is such as that molecules will move around. And what pool one now is connected with pool two. Now put the plugs back in. According to Jewish law, the fact that pool one had 100% kosher, we'll call kosher water for mikvah, and pool two had 100% non-kosher water for a mikvah, because it was tap water. When you undo that plug and the two waters mix in the two pools, they both become kosher. It's as if both pools are halachically, according to Jewish law, are considered kosher mikvahs. Then you close up, you put the plugs back in, and you do not touch pool number one. I will go into the mikvah in pool number two. Remember, it's now a kosher mikvah. It has kosher, the proper kosher water for mikvah. And I'll go in. Doesn't necessarily become dirty. But by the end of the day, if enough people used it, okay, it's time to drain the water. So let's drain it. Let's clean it. Let's fill it with tap water again. And now what are you going to do?
Loja.
Not closing anything. It's already been closed. I'm going to mess up pool number one.
Yeah.
It plugs out.
Now I'm going to take the plug out again. Pool one and pool two will now the waters will mix again. Put the plugs back in. Pool one is still 100% good. Pool two is 100% good. And now I have a clean kosher mikvah for the next day. And this is how it's done on a regular basis. Pool number one does not get touched because that's your source. If that gets dirty, you got to wait to collect 150 gallons worth of the rainwater again. Do you follow this? This is fascinating.
What if you run out of the kosher water?
What?
What if you run out of the kosher water?
You better pray for rain.
Okay, so do mikvahs close? I mean, I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, because thank God we design it this way so that pool number one really never gets touched and it remains.
Okay.
This is why you'll never see, if you go to a mikvah, if you go, you will never see pool number one unless somebody is going to give you a tour so that you can actually see and they'll show you where it is. But you as the customer, you as the client, you'll never see pool number one. You'll only see beautiful, pristine pool number two. And that's how you keep a mikvah kosher and clean on a regular basis. Now, I haven't told you why we're doing this. How does it work? We'll get there. I first want to describe for you, this is what a mikvah is. It is a collection of, and I'm using the word kosher in quotes, it's not a kosher, non-kosher. It's a matter of, is it a valid collection of rainwater, of water that can be used in the purification process? If it follows this design that I just laid out for you, the answer is yes. I have been to mikvahs. I'm sorry, Robin, give me one second. I have been to mikvahs that are in very large Jewish communities, including Baltimore, where it is very large. It's more than 150 gallons. It's probably 500 gallons. It's a massive pool. It's huge. But again, I don't need a 500 gallon pool number one. I only need a 150-gallon pool because that's my minimum source. And then I unplug, let the waters mish for a certain period of time. Technically, now you have two valid mikvahs. Close up the pool number one from number two. Everybody can go in pool number two and we're good to go. Go ahead, Robin.
So you were saying with engineers that they did this, this is now, like, was this always the case? Because
no, the answer was yes. The answer is yes, because while I'm simplifying it and saying engineers designed it and it has beautiful tile and it's a little pit. In the old days, you literally dug two pits.
Okay.
You dug it.
Gotcha.
Now, is it possible that in communities where they don't have, I guarantee you, let me put it this way. In communities where it doesn't rain a lot, they absolutely do it this way because you can't count on the rain. You can't count on it. In places like here in Maryland where, you know, it's April, it's May, we're going to get a bucket load of rain. It's not as big a concern because, okay, wait a week. It's not fair. You don't want people to have a mikvah closed like Alma said. It should never get to that point because you need a mikvah. As we will see just how important a mikvah is in a community. Arlene.
Well, how often do you use a mikvah?
Great question. The answer is on a Torah level, I'm not obligated. In where we live in today's day and age of where the laws of purity and impurity are for the most part, impractical. We don't have a temple. We don't have ways of really purifying. The only ones that are obligated are women when it's after their period and they want to become intimate with their husbands. That's the only time that officially that, and we'll see, doing if you buy dishes, we've all heard about, oh, you have to tovel them. You have to tovel new dishes. We're going to talk about that. A person who wants to convert to Judaism, part of the process is going to a mikvah. Those are the only cases in practical terms. I do go twice a year. My custom, it's a custom, it is not a law. My custom is to go Erev Rosh Hashanah, the day before Rosh Hashanah I go, and the day before Yom Kippur. Those are the two times that I go to the mikvah. Unless, like I had the opportunity about five weeks ago, I was the Sandik. The Sandik is the one who holds the baby at a circumcision ceremony. I had the privilege of holding that my grandson, and I was the Sandik. I took it upon myself because I know how great that honor is. I went to the mikvah as a sense of purifying myself before I got that opportunity and that honor. But that's pure custom, pure custom, not an obligation. Does that answer your question?
I thought they had to do it before they get married.
Again, you're talking about women who are preparing to be intimate with their husband. So yes, going to the mikvah before the wedding is preparing to be intimate for the wedding night.
I thought the man had to do it also.
It is not an obligation. Not an obligation. It's the right thing to do. Again, if you'll allow me tonight, it may go a little longer than usual, but you'll see that the concept that's being conveyed, it will answer your question why the customs have become before doing something of such magnitude, you want to go to a mikvah. It does add a level of purification. And that's what you want before your wedding, male or female. But the obligation officially is on the female in terms of readying herself for being intimate with her husband. Okay? Are we good so far? Okay. Nobody's left. That's a good sign. Okay. A mikvah. Oh, wait. Wayne's got more.
Yeah, Wayne's got more.
But if you mix the rainwater with the other water, doesn't that make that water partially contaminated?
No. That is a unique aspect in Jewish law, which I'm not going to get into the technical aspects of why it works that way. It does.
Okay.
When we get to the more advanced classes, maybe we'll cover it. I'll just have you know that to earn rabbinical ordination, to earn smicha, in many, many yeshivas, you have to learn the laws of mikvah backwards and forwards. And I'm not talking about just the purification process. You got to learn how you build it, how does it work? Way above the pay grade of this guy here, and certainly the level of where we're at now. So we'll have to shelve that question for a while. Okay? It is critical to have a mikvah in a Jewish community. It's critical for Jewish life. If I were to tell you, would it shock you, that it is more important to have a mikvah in a community than a shul, than a synagogue? Yes, it is 100% fact. Not having a synagogue means, okay, I can't have a way to get together. I don't have a designated place. Not having a mikvah is going to have implications on everybody's home life, husbands and wives. Because without a mikvah, then we run into questions about intimacy. So, critical. It's more important than a synagogue. According to Jewish law, you're not considered a technical community if you don't have a mikvah. You want to know how important it was to have a mikvah? Any of you been to Masada in Israel?
Yes.
Yeah? You know, they had a mikvah, right? Wrong. They had two. There were two mikvahs that were found on top of Masada. We're talking about people that are trying to run away from Roman persecution. And they're hiding out for as long as they can. They're the last stronghold. And they're worrying about some verstunkene pool? They're worried about some reservoir of rainwater? Good Lord, it's in the desert. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The answer is that Jewish life cannot continue if there's no mikvah. It's critical in Jewish life. There are three categories of commandments, of mitzvot in the Torah. If we had to organize, most of the time we'll say, if you want to break it up, we say positive commandments, negative commandments, the do's and the don'ts. But there's another way to break them up. We call them mishpatim. Number one would be mishpatim, which means laws. Any kind of law, anyone with good judgment would find obvious reasons and obvious rationales why to have such laws. Simple. A law in the Torah that says don't murder. Okay, that's a logical, that makes sense to human comprehension. That's a mishpat. That's a law that makes sense. It's necessary to live in harmony to create some kind of society. Don't steal. Don't cheat. Don't damage others. If you do damage, there's tort law. There's business law. You have to adjudicate and figure out how much. Those are mishpatim. Those are laws that make sense, easily understood in the fabric of society. There's another group of mitzvot that are called edut, testimony. These are where practices that bear witness to important concepts, right? Rituals, festivals that reawaken certain key events. The fact that we sit on Pesach, on Passover, and we recount the story of the Exodus, and we eat matzah. Those, I can't say that's a logical thing to do. It's not something if we decided on forming our own society. Oh, I got a good one. Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think we should all eat unleavened bread. That's what we need to do. These crackers, they're a must-have for this year. That's ridiculous. It's not a logical mitzvah, but it does remind us and bear testimony and witness to an event that actually took place. Shabbos is the same story. Putting on tefillin, it's not a logical thing, but it commemorates certain aspects, key truths in Judaism. That's the second category. So you have mishpatim, which are laws. The second are edus, which are testimonies. And then you hit this third category called chukim, statutes. They are just laws that are dictated with no apparent, I say that word very, very strongly, no apparent reason. It's a decree. God said to do it. What it does is it strengthens the bond between man and his creator, right? But how it's accomplished, it's not relative, it's not obvious. Like the laws of kosher. Yes, I know you will read many, many articles that tell you that kosher is a healthier diet and it really is. I don't necessarily think that's the reason. Might there be a health benefit to it? Maybe. But the age old, don't eat pig because it's a filthy creature and it's going to give you the cooties and all that. I don't buy it. I really don't buy it. I can't believe that's what the Torah is telling us. There's much, much greater reasons to it. Okay? But it's no apparent reason. Going to the mikvah on the surface is no apparent reason. How is it that I'm ritually impure? I go into this pool of water, immerse myself, and I come out, and now magic, presto, change-o, all the impurity is gone, and great, now we're all back to the way it was. It doesn't seem on the surface to really an obvious reason. In fact, the Midrash and many other sources will tell us that the nations of the world, Satan himself would mock us, would mock the Jewish people and laugh and say, what are you doing? This stuff makes no sense. You guys are going through motions. It's illogical. Nevertheless, the Torah teaches us that there are times where we have to be strong and know that in our heart that it is for our benefit. How? Not always can we find the answers easily. But if we dig a little deeper, I believe that we can understand much, much better. I was going to go off and talk more about this idea, but I'm going to hold off. If we have time at the end, Alina, I'll come back to it. Go ahead, Charles. Sorry.
How long do you have to stay in the water?
Okay, we'll get there. You don't have to stay long. Okay, I'll deal with it now. Fair enough. What happens is the person who goes to the mikvah puts on their special birthday suit. Wink, wink. Okay? Do I have to explain? Okay, good. Okay, you wear your birthday suit, and all you have to do is literally immerse your entire body underwater for a moment, as long as your whole body goes under. That's it. You're done. Here's where custom comes in. Some have the custom to immerse themselves 3 times. Some do it 7 times. The point is that 1 time is sufficient. If you go and immerse yourself, now again, I'm oversimplifying it. That means you have to pick your feet up off the floor also. The water has to immerse. Literally, you are surrounded and engulfed by water. No, Arlene, you do not have to open your mouth and swallow the water. You don't have to take scuba lessons. It's not that complicated. But Charles, you do have to be totally immersed. That's it. Done. Then you come out, put your other suit on, and you're ready to go back to life. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Wayne.
But I heard that if you have long hair, you have to make sure you're down far enough.
Okay, you're right. A lot of technical stuff. Like I said, all of you has to be immersed at the same time under the water. Yes, for guys like you and me, Wayne, we don't have this problem of our hair sticking up. As soon as I put my head underneath, I am good to go. However, some of you ladies or some of you men with long, bushy beards do have to be careful that when you go under, the hair doesn't go flying up, which it naturally does. Because if you've ever gone swimming, you know, right? The hair goes up. The hair stays at the... You have to make sure that your hair is all under. That is correct. Okay? A lot of technical stuff. If you have a question, I'll answer it. But otherwise, it's not germane to the understanding. Go ahead, Robin.
My mom's doing great, everybody. So thank you. Yeah, she's good now. But because I had to go for a second, just really quick, the third category, because I just want to take it from my notes.
Are what's called chukim. They're called statutes. And we're no apparent reason. It's a decree. God said to do it. Even though I may not easily understand why.
Okay, thank you.
So let's try to understand. Where in the Torah does it talk about the usage of purifying, of a mikvah? So the first time that it's brought down is where Aaron, Moshe's brother Aaron, he and all of his sons are now going to be consecrated as Kohanim, as a Kohen. They're going to become Kohanim, and they're going to be the leaders and representatives in the service for God on behalf of the Jewish people, right? You're all familiar with this. The Torah tells us that Aaron and his sons, for their consecration, needed to have that purification. Similarly, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, on Yom Kippur has to immerse himself numerous times during the Yom Kippur service. Let's be very clear. This has nothing to do with removing physical dirt. This is not a matter of the Torah is mandating that we stay hygienically clean, and therefore this is the Torah's way of making sure we bathe and shower. No, no, no. That is not the case. In fact, the law is that if you have dirt on you, if you have dirt, let's say you just finished a great game or you worked out or whatever it is, and you got sweat all over you, you can't just hop in the mikvah. It won't work. You can't do that because you first have to have your body clean. Then you can go through the purification process. And here's where it can get super technical. You're right, Wayne, in terms of the hair. How about the dirt under our fingernails? We don't even pay attention to this sometimes. If you have long nails, that could present a problem. You have to be clean, physically clean. So going to the mikveh has nothing to do with removing any sense of filth. It's what it is all about. And this is the punchline, ladies and gentlemen. The usage of the mikveh, the purification process, is where there is a change in elevation, in status. You are changing the status of something. Let's take a case. I go to the store. My wife and I, thank God, were married a few years, and it was time to get new dishes. My wife hinted at it numerous times, and finally, knucklehead got the hint, and we went ahead and we got new dishes. Okay? Everybody knows that when you buy new dishes, you have to tovel them. That's the word. Tovel means immerse. What do? You put them in a mikvah. Now, wait. I could feel the eyes searing through me at this. No, I am not going to kill two birds with one stone. And the next time my wife goes to the mikvah and say, hey, honey, do you mind taking 6 plates with you while you go? No. Here in Baltimore and in many other communities, we are very blessed to have what's called a kelim mikvah. Kelim means vessels, dishes, pots, pans. You don't have to go into that building where the women or the men are unclothed. No. Again, like I'm coming in and I want to do my cups and pots and pans and she's coming out. No, this is not going to work. This is a one, right? You need a stop sign. Who's coming in? No. In many, many communities, you have a dedicated mikvah for the women, dedicated mikvah for the men in another part, and you have a dedicated mikvah just for immersing your dishes, your pots, your pans, and stuff like that. It makes sense. Now, it's not necessarily true in every community. In a community I lived before Baltimore, we didn't have a dedicated halim mikvah for pots and pans and dishes. But there were certain hours of the day where it was dedicated for that. Okay, so you knew that you weren't walking in when you weren't supposed to and somebody was doing what they got to do. So that's how it works. But why? I'm going ahead and I buy these great dishes from Macy's. Macy's, I'm sure they're excellent dishes. You know, I'm not going to get it at, Ollie's Bargain Outlet. This is my wife we're talking about here. Okay, so what do I have to go ahead and I have to tovel them in a mikvah? Why? They're dishes, for goodness sakes. What's they got to do with impurities and purification? But wait, where else do we have it? We have it after a person passes away. As part of the burial society, the Chevra Kadisha, the wonderful work that they do to prepare a Jewish body for burial, there is, it's not exactly the same, but there is some immersion in a mikvah for the deceased. It's a purification, not because there's any dirt. This is not a physical thing. This is purely an elevation in status. And finally, the third case is what we're talking about is family purity between husband and wife. The easiest way to understand this change in status is to talk about somebody who converts to Judaism. Now, let me just take 30 seconds and tell you what's so beautiful about that. In some religions, someone once asked me, is Judaism a nation, a race, or a religion? A nation, a race, or a religion? You have to think about that. It's not. Maybe we'll do a class on that. But if you choose any of those three, you by definition preclude others. If it's a race, for example, then either you're born of that race or you're not. You can't become that race. I can want all I want, but I can't be Asian. It's not me. I can't be that. I'm not from that race. I'm not. And we learned, unfortunately, in World War II and the Holocaust, there was a group of people that based their decisions as to who gets to live and not based on an Aryan race. Judaism doesn't believe in that concept. Judaism says that you can be born of a different faith, of a different religion, of a different, not as a Jewish, no Jewish DNA, yet you have the right to become Jewish. That is something that a person has the right to choose. And vice versa. A person can be born Jewish even if they don't practice anything. They're still Jewish. So it's not a race, it's not a religion, and it's not a nation. It's really a combination of all three, unique. But anyway, what does the Talmud tell us about somebody who converts? I want you to listen so carefully to the wording that's used. The Talmud gives an insight about the function of a mikvah. It says, I'll read you the words itself. As soon as the convert immerses and emerges, he is like a Jew in every way. A convert who embraces Judaism is like a newborn child. Brand new, spanking fresh new. Literally wet behind the ears. Sorry.
And the rest of you,
sorry, sorry. It's been a long day. The fact, listen to the terminology. It's so beautiful. The Torah is telling us that when a person emerges from a mikvah, they are a new creature. They are not what they were before. There is a total change. When I take my Macy's dishes and I immerse them in a mikvah, they have now been elevated to the status that these are dishes that will house and hold kosher food. It's elevating its status. It's not just a dish from Macy's. It's now been elevated to be used in the service of used for kosher food. When they go ahead and Aaron and his sons are being consecrated for a service to God for the very first time, they go to a mikvah because they're being elevated and changing their status from regular dude to Kohen. That now changes. When a woman goes to the mikvah, she elevates her status that she is now be able to be intimate with her husband. You say, but when did that change? When did she quote unquote lose that status? This begs the question. Let's spend a few minutes talking about this. What happens? Let's do it this way. Let's start this way. I'm trying to think that's the best way to do this. We know, it's a terrible example and I apologize, but let's talk about a lobster. I know, sorry. Okay, let's talk about a lobster. A lobster, when it's a little lobster, it has a shell. It has a, you know, whatever it's got to protect it because it's got a soft body and it needs a hard shell to protect it from birds of prey and any other creatures that want to eat it. But what happens when the lobster grows? What happens?
It sheds its shell.
It has to. Thank you, Muriel. It has to shed its shell so that it grows a larger one, one that will fit its new body. But the only way that that can happen is that it has to first get rid of what it was. That's the only way. It's the only way for it to attain that. To attain a new status, you need to lose or nullify the previous state. A woman, sorry guys, but a woman is on a higher spiritual level than a man. Fact. Why? because a woman's body allows them to create life. We, at best, are donors. Obviously, a necessary part of the puzzle in order to create life, but it is the woman who actually nurtures and creates and births a new creature, a new living being. That is godly. Only God creates people. A woman can do that. Therefore, the moment where a woman, right? That's really intimacy between a husband and wife. We talked about this last week. Although it's not limited to creating another child, there's intimacy for its own sake to create that bond between husband and wife. One of the major reasons for it is to procreate, is so that you can have children. That's what the goal is, right? So you go ahead, and the woman now has that ability, because we give our donor, our donation, and the woman's egg, it fertilizes, and she's able to then become pregnant and birth a child. What happens if it doesn't take? As is often the case, it's not every time that husband and wife are intimate are they able to create a child. So what happens? That opportunity to be, for the woman, to be godly, godlike on the highest possible level, that opportunity is now lost. No fault, it's a fact. Once that, meaning when she starts her cycle, that means it's a sign that that month they were not fortunate. It didn't happen. No egg was fertilized and she's not pregnant. The opportunity to create life was lost on that month. Try again next month. That loss of opportunity for potential life in its wake, when it's not capitalized, is where impurity now resides. Think about what I'm telling you. The highest level of purity is to be more godly, godlike. When there is a child created, it's the greatest godly activity a human being can possibly do. That's purity, or the opportunity for purity. When that is lost, in its wake comes impurity. Think about it in scientific terms. There is no such thing. What's the expression? The universe abhors a vacuum. Right? It doesn't allow for there to be an emptiness. It has to get filled with something, right? You've all heard this terminology, right? The universe can't allow for nothingness to be. So something has to fill. And if it's not going to be filled with the positive, the productive aspect, the creation of mankind, another child, then it will by definition get filled with black. It will get filled with impurity. When a woman has her cycle, means that opportunity for reaching that godly state was now lost. In its wake comes impurity. The way to get out of that impurity is going to the mikvah, and we'll talk why that is. That's the global picture here. It is tied directly to the woman's cycle. And therefore, the Torah says that when a woman has her period, the men, the wife, husbands and wives, should not be intimate. Not only because it may not be physically comfortable, understandably, but because that opportunity was lost, and now in its wake there is impurity, that has to change before husband and wife are together again. Because to create the positive, another opportunity to create a child. This is where the laws of family purity come in. The laws dictate and give this idea that when the woman has her cycle, husband and wife are not intimate. That is in the Torah. I'm fleshing it out with much more detail than you'll read in a cursory glance reading through the Torah. But that is the idea. Going to the mikvah means that there was a change. You went ahead and you abolished the previous state. That which was impure, going to the mikvah now gets rid of it. Here's an example. Okay? Let's go back to a historical event. We all know the story of Noah and the flood. Yes? Why did God bring the flood? Simple. Why? Why did he do it?
In the earth.
Why?
Sin and corruption on
right.
earth.
Because the world had become so corrupt. It was right. It was filled with sin. And God said, enough is enough. So, quote unquote, as a punishment, he wipes out everybody and he starts again with Noah and his family. Am I correct? Is that a fair assessment?
Yes.
Yes.
Wrong. Not totally true. Because I purposely snuck it in there. It's not a punishment. God could have easily wiped out the universe by giving the old I Dream of Jeannie blink, and then poof, everybody's gone. Why specifically a flood?
Cleansing, wasn't
it? It have to be a flood. See, now you're beginning to think, this has water. To do with water. Just got through telling me that water is used in the process of
purification.
Perhaps we can understand the story of Noah a little bit better, and that it wasn't just an indiscriminate punishment. God said, let's get rid of them. I'm just going to bring a flood. No, it was specifically a way through the water, nullifying its previous state of impurity, of the sins that had corrupted the universe. It had to be, quote unquote, immersed in a mikvah. Fascinating. How large does the mikvah, what's the minimum amount? So I threw out the number 150 gallons. Where'd I get that from? The Torah doesn't talk in terms of gallons, to the best of my knowledge. Okay. Rather, it uses measurements that were relevant at the time. It's called a sa'ah, S-E, apostrophe A-H, sa'ah. A sa'ah, it's a measurement. How many sa'ah does a minimum mikvah have to be? What's the minimum? 40. 40 sa'ah. That's the measurement. That's what equals approximately 150 gallons. But that's the terminology. The bare minimum for a mikvah has to be 40 sa'ah. How many days and nights did it rain?
40.
40 days and 40 nights, the flood was brought. Coincidence? I think not. If you want to go ahead and you want to know about purification process, it's got to be tied to that number 40, because that's what a mikvah has to be. So usage of water, 40 days and 40 nights, equaling the 40 sa'ah, it also would explain that the Jewish people, when they left Egypt, they also had to go through a purification process from slave mentality to finally get to be the Jewish people going into the land of Israel. How long did they wander in the desert?
40 years.
Oh, interesting. 40 years. And Moses is on the mountain how many days getting the Torah?
40 days.
40 days and 40 nights. And from the beginning of the month of Elul through Yom HaKippurim, through Yom Kippur, those days of introspection and repentance, 40 days. This number will appear over and over and over again, because that's the number. These are the two factors. The medium of water and the number 40 are the two ingredients that describe the purification process. Now, why? Why is it specifically water in particular? So have I totally blown your brains yet, and that you have no room for more, or we can keep going here? I see some of you like, yeah, I'm good to go. Thanks.
I'm good to go.
Well, you can always hopefully listen to this again and get more of this. But you have to take this one level deeper to appreciate why is water the mechanism by which purification comes about? Where is the source? Like, why would this be? So let's talk about my favorite story in the Torah. My absolute favorite go-to story in the Torah is
Garden of Eden.
Garden of Eden.
That is by far my favorite story. Okay? Because it all comes back to that. I want to read you a little bit about this story. You know what? I wrote it down here. I have to read it here. Here's what it says. God planted a garden in Eden to the east, and placed there the man whom he had formed. And God caused to sprout from the ground every tree that was pleasing to the sight and good for food. Also the tree of life in the midst of the garden and the tree of knowledge of good and bad. A river issues forth from Eden to water the garden, and from there it is divided and becomes four headwaters. And the Torah then lists, first one was called Pishon, second one was called Gihon, third one is called Chidekel, the fourth one is called Prat. Continues the story. God took the man, placed him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to guard it. God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you shall freely eat. But of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, you must not eat thereof, for on the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. And we all know the end of the story. It's like the old Cosby routine, right? Where is it, right? He wants to know exactly where's the tree, because that's the first place they're going, okay? To the best of your knowledge, in the entire story of Adam and Eve sinning and eating from what they were not supposed to, or anything thereafter, do we hear anything about this river that runs through Eden and it splits and it goes into four headwaters? Like, what has this got to do with the price of tea in China? This has nothing to do with the story on the surface. It's totally interrupting the narrative for no apparent reason. It doesn't play a role. It doesn't say Adam and Eve were skinny dipping and then they got it in their heads that they're going to go eat from this tree. This river has nothing to do with the story. And we never seem to come back to it. Muriel, you slept well last night? How? I'm asking you a question that should keep you up all night, every night. Is it a fair question? I mean, we've heard this story many times. Do you ever wonder about it?
Not about the river.
Right. It doesn't, and in the best of you not, it doesn't seem to play a role in any of the story. So who cares? Again, the Torah is not interested in you winning Jewish Trivial Pursuit and just throwing random facts at you. This has to have relevance to the story. And yet, on the surface, it doesn't. Okay. We've spoken many, many times. The essence of the story of the Garden of Eden is the story about choice, about having free will to choose. That is, you know, one of the main issues, one of the main fundamental principles that we always come back to in terms of the basics. God created the world because he wants to bestow goodness to us, but he doesn't want to do it as a handout. So we have to earn it. To earn it, you have to have two choices, a good and a bad. Follow God or turn away from God. We've gone through this. Fine. Free will exists. Fine. Whatever the tree means, fine. Before they eat from the tree of knowledge, right? This perfected state, Adam and Eve were in a perfected state. Their body and their soul were in perfect harmony. We've spoken about this. They were able to attain, to achieve some level of perfection, both spiritually and physically. Only after they sinned are they now mortal. Right? This is what the decree is. They will now die. That was not what the intention was. Ultimately, God chooses the Jewish people to recreate that Garden of Eden and that elevate mankind. That's the building, that's the giving of the Torah, the building of the tabernacle, the temple, all of this. Fine. Fast forward. Here's what's interesting. What makes a person impure? How does a person get impure? If I speak too long, do I become impure? Some of you are hoping. What's the classic way a person can become ritually impure?
Committing a sin.
Nope.
Being in the presence of something dead.
Oh, where there is in close proximity to death. That's why when you go to a cemetery, even nowadays where we don't really apply the laws of purity and purity, after we leave the cemetery, we wash our hands. It's not because we got our hands dirty. It's ritual. This is a spiritual impurity because we were in close proximity or actually we're dealing with the death, the deceased. Where does all sense of impurity come from? The source goes back to the fact that somebody now dies. Had there been no death in the world, there would be no impurity. Impurity is a ramification because there's death. Had Adam and Eve not sinned, they would have lived immortal. They would have lived eternally. There would be no death. You say, how do you know? Because that's the punishment. The punishment for eating and going against God's decree was thorns and thistles. You're going to work the field, and Adam and Eve is going to have, birth pain and pregnancy. And you know what? Guess what? You're both in the same boat, out of the garden, because now you're going to die. Now you become mortal. All sense of impurity comes about in connection to death and dying. That's where it comes from. Therefore, we have to make sure that any level of connection with impurity or death and dying, for that case, doesn't come in contact with the Garden of Eden. You say, but we don't have the Garden of Eden, Rabbi. Yeah. What was the law? If you were ritually impure, let's say you just came back from a funeral. Now you're impure. Okay. Were you allowed to enter the temple? No. The law was you were not allowed to because you were impure. Why not? I can enter my house. I can enter your house. Why can't I be in the temple? Because the temple is the mini Garden of Eden. You can't have impurity in the Garden of Eden. That's only a result of breaking the laws and going and being thrown out. Contact or any contact with the dead, or ultimately all impurity is a result of the sin. Therefore, how do we get out of this problem? A person became impure. They went to a cemetery. It was a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to deal with those who passed away. It's a beautiful mitzvah. One of the nicest mitzvahs out there. Hard, painful, sad, but it is one of the nicest things because you can never get repaid. That person can never repay the favor. You see, if I lend you money, in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, I'll do that because one day I may need to borrow from you. So I'm basically looking out for myself. I'm going to be nice to you because one day I'm going to say, hey, Sharish is having a fundraiser. I need help, right? That's the only reason I'm nice, because I want to get paid back. But somebody who passed away, there's no way for them to repay you. So it's one of the nicest, most beautiful mitzvahs in the Torah. However, let's go back to the Garden of Eden. And I'm going to tie this all together now. The Torah tells us a description about this beautiful place. It's a garden. What do we have there? God caused to sprout from the ground every tree that pleasing to the sight, good for food. It has peach trees, apple trees, apricots, and it's got watermelon trees. Okay. And it's got all these beautiful things growing in there. And it's just, everything is so delicious. Right? And also it has the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and bad. And you know what else is there? A river. A river issues forth from Eden to water the garden, and it divides and becomes four headwaters. And what has this got to do with it? God knows his creations. God knows full well that Adam and Eve, because he gave them free choice, you know what might happen? What might happen when they have free will? They might choose incorrectly. They might choose poor. They might choose the evil. And then what's going to happen? God knows. He's going to banish them. Is there no way back? Are Adam and Eve and all of their descendants forever going to be stuck in a state of impurity? Is there no way to connect back to that idyllic world of the Garden of Eden where there's a harmonious relationship between body and soul, between man and God? Is that never going to be allowed ever again? God put in a fail-safe. He put in a little safety net for Adam and Eve. He was hoping upon hoping, really hope against hope, that man would choose properly and not go against his commandments. But just in case he would, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to build into the Garden of Eden a river. And you know where this river goes when it leaves the garden? It goes everywhere. It goes across the world. It divides into four headwaters that go in all directions. So that in Frederick, Maryland, there's a natural body of water. It's called a creek. Did I get that right? Right? There's a natural body of water. There's an ocean. There's a river. There's a stream. No matter where on this beautiful world you go, you will have water, a natural body of water that ultimately, if you were to follow it, you would finding its source back to the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve, listen to this. I'm not suggesting it's a proof, but I love the fact that the Midrash tells us that after Adam and Eve were banished from the Garden of Eden, do you know the first place they went? I'll read you the words of the Midrash. The Midrash says, after Adam was driven from the garden, he sat in a river and repented. Oh, I don't care. I don't care where he sat. He stood. He sat. I mean, what difference does that make to me? The point is that he knew that physically he couldn't go back into the garden. He was banished. But can I not reconnect? Is there no way to purify myself that I can reconnect to that higher level? Yes, there is. Through the medium of water. Because all natural bodies of water find its way back to the Garden of Eden. So when a person goes to a mikvah, they are, again, as we described, they are going and immersing themselves in a natural body of water. It is collected. Didn't go through pipes, so to say. You are connecting on that Garden of Eden level again. When a person immerses in a mikvah, they're reestablishing with that perfected state, that more purified state of where we can shed that status of impurity. And just as a convert is reborn, new, as if it's a fresh new child, a clean slate into that state of purity and can re-enter. It's not surprising that the word mikvah are the same letters as koma. Koma means to stand tall again. You get to stand erect. Because after we sin, we should be humbled, we should be bowed, we should be subdued. But going to the mikvah, we get to stand up tall again. Our question, why interrupt the narrative? The Torah tells us that God planted the garden and in it was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Therefore, the possibility for sin existed. The possibility of getting evicted from the Garden of Eden now became real. Even before he put man in the garden, he made sure that there was a link between the Garden of Eden and the rest of the world by having this river, which would flow in all directions. So that ultimately, no matter how our status changed for a sense of impurity, we have the opportunity always to reconnect and elevate it back to the status of pure. That's the gist of a mikvah. To bring it to the final point of why a woman now goes, and what's this concept? Why would this be part and parcel of the rhythm of a husband and wife relationship? The Talmud itself asks this as a question, and I'll read it to you. Why did the Torah decree that the impurity of menstruation should continue for 7 days? Because when a husband is with his wife continuously, they might come to loathe each other. Therefore, the Torah said that they should be in a state of impurity for 7 days in order that she and he be as beloved to each other as the time when she first came into the bridal chamber. If husbands and wives are constantly with each other and there's never a time of where it's quote unquote off limits and it's whenever, whatever, there's no longing, there's no anticipation. I have heard this from so many people who have learned this magic of family purity, how it builds their relationship. How wonderful it is that it's kept fresh. If you speak to people who unfortunately their relationships didn't survive, often, I'm not saying it's always, and there's always many, many, many reasons, but there's a certain It's basically you go on a honeymoon every month because there's that longing. I can't wait to be with him. I can't wait to be with her. That keeps a marriage fresh. It's never too late. You say to me, okay, some of you are a little bit past that stage. I understand. I'm not. I'll throw it out like this. If anyone would like to learn more, if anyone would like to take a tour of a mikvah, if you've never seen one, come. I will go ahead. I will get a lady as well, because sometimes the questions are more appropriate for the ladies. But either way, go to a mikvah if you want to see it. If you've never actually immersed in it, it's not too late. You say, yeah, but I'm past that stage, Rabbi. Yeah. But if you still are married, being intimate with your spouse, there's still reason to go. I can explain this another time. But suffice it to say that the beauty of the bedroom, the loving relationship that a husband and a wife have, very much in line with the physicality, the bond that is built, you have to understand that if there's no structure to it, of where it keeps it fresh, it keeps the longing, the loving for each other to be intimate, you have to have some system in place. That's where the laws of family purity come in, and that's where the mikvah, as the last stage in that process of where the status is changed and elevated, that's the last piece to it. The night that a woman goes to the mikvah is very often a wonderful bonding experience again between a husband and a wife. I can tell you from my own personal experience, it's a wonderful, wonderful experience. I'll leave it at that. But just understand that this is what a mikvah is. It's not all of these crazy ideas with myths and filth and the woman is an impure creature. Nothing of the sort. It's elevating the status. Go ahead, Fred. I'm sure there are a lot of questions.
This was about 15 years ago when I had a study partner, and we studied, I think it came out of Baruchas. And all I remember, I remember this thing that if a man, I guess I can be as blunt as possible, but I want to do it nicely. If a man has an emission, let's say, he can't say the Shema until he's clean.
Right.
And so when you said that only the women, I thought that at that point it meant that if you were going to be that orthodox, you would after, let's say you had relations, you would also emerge in a mikveh so that you would.
Nowadays, as I said before, the laws of purity and impurity, you're talking about the Mishnaic era. You're talking about what the Mishnah or the Gemara is talking about in temple times where they were very careful about purity and impurity. Nowadays, it is not the case. There's no requirement, even after relations or remissions, that a man has to go. In those days, and it will be eventually, when we go back to the laws of purity and impurity with a temple, then yes, it would be that the man, if he has relations that night with his wife, the next morning before he goes to Dav and Shacharis, he would go to the mikvah. There are many people today, more in the Hasidic circles, where they go to the mikvah every morning. Not because of emissions, but because of their purification. They want to go into the day. They want to go ahead and start their davening properly. They go to the mikveh every morning. That's okay. More in the Hasidic circles, but it's not required.
And I just remember reading that, and it said you can't say the Shema.
Yeah, because you are at a state of impurity.
Impurity, right.
But nowadays, we're all impure at this point. We have no way out. Going to the mikveh only removes some degree. You know the story with the red heifer and the ash?
We don't have the red heifer anymore.
Right, so we don't have that nowadays. So by definition, by default, we all have some level of impurity that we can't get rid of. Right. Not until Mashiach. Robin.
So I think you were alluding to this at the end. So when a woman is past the time when she has her menstrual cycle, it's then not required for her to go to the mikvah?
She goes one last time because at some point after her last cycle, if she goes back, you know, there's a woman, let's say a woman who is careful and she goes to the mikveh every month, right? Mm-hmm. When she doesn't have the period the last time, she's good to go. It's just whatever after the last period is the last time she'll go. If she hits menopause the next week,
Right.
Okay, done.
So there's no reason for a woman to go to a mikveh after that?
Nope.
What did you say?
Nope. There's no reason. I mean, she's welcome to go, but there's no obligation. Her status never changes now. She's in a state of purity. She only gets that sense of impurity when the lost opportunity for a child. But if she doesn't have her cycle, then she doesn't have that opportunity anymore. She hit menopause. There's no more eggs to give out.
Can I ask?
I'm only saying that a woman who, let's say, hasn't gone her whole life, a woman who has not done it, right? And you say it's already been 20 years since I had my last cycle. It's too late already. My answer is no, it's not. It's not too late. Because technically, if a person hasn't gone to the mikvah since their last cycle, then they're still in that state of impurity. Going to the mikvah will take them out of it, and then they're done forevermore.
But once they're done forevermore, there's no way that a woman can up her, as you said, her level or her
stage. Doesn't have to. She's already at the highest level she can attain.
Okay, but what if through normal life she's not at, or she doesn't think that she's at her highest level?
One second. I'm not suggesting, let's clarify this. Just because a woman goes to the mikvah, I hate to say, she's not perfect.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that.
Everybody, there's no more mechanism to take it higher once a person goes to a mikvah. You can't, there's no mechanism in place to take it to a higher level of purification. Without the red heifer and that whole process and all of that stuff, there's no way to get higher. Does that mean that that I feel that there's no room for me to improve myself? No, I'm not suggesting that at all.
Right, but mikvah is not the way for a woman anymore after she's done having her periods.
We're using the word purification incorrectly now. I'm talking about specifically about an impurity that is associated with the menstrual cycle.
Right.
You're talking about improving yourself.
Right, right.
Those are two separate things.
We as women get to to another stage to better ourselves.
Just keep doing what you're doing. Improve your character the same way you go through your life. The mikvah is in place for specific impurity associated with the cycle. That's okay. Its function.
What the mikvah is for.
For
the women. Again, the menstrual cycle.
If I want to go ahead, I'll give you this example. Like I was given the honor of being the sandik for my grandchild's bris, right? I felt that would be a good opportunity for me to purify myself. Did I change any actual status? No, I did not. I didn't change any of my pure or impure status. But it got me in the right frame of mind. It gave me a spiritual jolt that when I came out, I said, okay, you know what? When I go to davening now, I'm going to put extra focus because, you know, hey, I'm in a good state. I'm pure. Yeah. Yeah. You can use it as an impetus, as a means to excite yourself and say, I want to be, that's fine. Anybody can do that. But
I get it. But what is there for a woman?
The same way. If she wants to go, she can go. There's no prohibition against it. It's not normal. It's not a normal thing to do to say, I want to improve myself, so I'm going to go to the mikvah. A woman doesn't need to do that. She can.
She doesn't need to do it. Okay.
She does not need to do that. It's not a requirement at all. It's not a requirement for a man either.
It's just something that if you feel that if you do that, you're even closer to
if you want to use it as an impetus to be better and to improve yourself, okay, make an appointment with the mikvah and go. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not normal. It's not the normal course of how we would do it. What we would do, if you really want to improve, you say, you know what, Rabbi, I want to start listening to more classes. I want to learn about the laws of Shabbos. I want to improve my speech and not saying Lashon Hara. okay, let's learn about it. Let's talk about it. How can we do this? And let's go on a trip to go see the, okay.
That's and I guess it. My question, is this an avenue for myself to improve myself? And the answer
I would
is
not recommend it as a course of action. If you want to go, if you want to go one time and do that as your kickstart, go right ahead. But I would not recommend it. I would not recommend it on a regular basis to go month in and month out if it's not associated with the cycle. I would not use that as the course of action.
I understand.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
This is a lofty concept. Go ahead, Susan.
It's kind of a big question, and maybe out of the scope of now, but where do infertile women come into the picture here in terms of the aspect of, from my understanding, that this is connected with a woman's capacity to give birth, and if each month that is not happening and it's found out it can't happen, is there anything around that? I mean,
again, it's more of a technicality. If a woman has a cycle, then the mikvah is a part of the process. If a woman doesn't have that cycle, she never goes through that menstruating period, she's not required to go to the mikvah. Now, I know women who have fertility issues, and it's on both sides of the spectrum of where they bleed too often and the cycle is too short, or vice versa. It's such a long cycle. It doesn't, medical science has come a long, long, long way, right? And miracle babies are born every day, thank God, because of this, right? But it doesn't change the fact that it's a technical thing. If a person has uterine bleeding, that could and should facilitate a mikvah visit. We can get into further, there are various medical procedures that actually open up the uterus, right? It goes higher than normal, right? Again, I don't know if I want to put this on tape, whatever, but you know, here, hold on one second.
I think.
Well, thank you. I think it's true. I mean, you've all had your stories, but I guess for me, let me just wrap it up because the hour is very, very late. We went on a mission. We went on a mission tonight to try to understand the second half of what intimacy and what a loving relationship in a bedroom is all about. And I guess my point that I'm trying to make is that to truly appreciate being together, you have to have periods of separation. That's really, and the way it works, the Torah's description, and again, if it's somebody, this is all brand new to you, it sounds like absolute chaos and it's, you know, there's a method to the madness that enlightens and really nurtures the relationship between the husband and the wife. And the mikvah, and again, I have very limited experience, but my wife and many of the people who I've spoken to who've had the experience, they all say it. They all say it without exception, that it is an enlightening experience. They feel just so good. They feel elevated when they come out of the mikvah, and that just enhances their own life, and it enhances their relationship with their husband. So on that, we'll call it a night. I'm happy to answer any other questions, but I think at this point, I think we're good. We'll find another room to go to next week. And then we're winding down. We have only a couple of classes left. All right. Very good. Thank you for bearing with me through the whole class. Happy to have you.